Welcome to Exploration 1, Modules 4 and 5. Yes, we are revisiting Module 4, because I'm not going to put last week's recording up, it was really dicey. We will do this week's recording, which will be somewhat a condensed version of what last week's was. Now, payment. I have to mention this on lecture because people keep telling me that I haven't mentioned this, and we'll be mentioning it again tomorrow. Payment is meant to be, if you've already paid, you can catch some Zeds for about 45 seconds. Payment is meant to be paid by the 1st of September, or you need to tell us how and when and whatever that you're going to pay your course fees. The course fees are payable on www.qcat.org. You can get to where you pay your fees by pressing B for button if using JAWS, or you can find the donate and pay your course fees button. You should have been informed of the cost of the courses when you enrolled. If for some reason, however, you are unsure, you can email CAVI instructors and we will set you straight. It is possible to pay your fees off in a number of payments. However, we need to know about it. If you have not paid by a certain time, then we start looking at ways to encourage you to pay. Thank you to all of you who have already paid. And we know that there are a couple of people who don't pay due to economic considerations. Alrighty, anybody got any questions about that? Alright, I will take the incredible silence as a benchmark that there are no questions about that. Alright, if you have any questions about that, you can drop us an email to caviinstructors@gots.net, which will soon, once I fix it up today, be caviinstructors@qcat.org, which will be kind of cool. That will happen a bit later today. But obviously I can't SSH into the server and lecture at the same time. Alrighty. Now, I'm going to quickly re-go over the OSI reference model, because this is one of these models that is going to go all the way through the course, and as much as we loathe, hate, and detest it, it's everywhere, and you need to know it. Okay? There are a number of ways to remember the OSI reference model. One is, please do not throw sausage pizza away, or physical data link network transport session presentation application. Or all people seem to need data processing, which sounds as though it was written by somebody who wanted to justify their job. Application, process, presentation, session, transport, network, data link, physical. There is also another one that says, Australia Post stinks, they never deliver parcels. So if you're in Australia, that might be an easier one for you to remember than all people seem to need data processing. Now, would anybody like me to take a whip through the layers and say what they all do? Alrighty. We will start at the bottom, and we will talk about the physical layer. The physical layer is responsible for the type of medium that a network transfer is occurring on, whether it's transferring on fiber, wireless, or copper. It usually concerns itself with the voltages, the levels, how the bits are encoded. The protocol unit for the physical data link is bits. Bits, 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 bits. Okay? And I will go through all of these different names for these things in a minute. The data link layer is responsible for framing. In other words, it's how you put the frames onto, say, an Ethernet and stuff. It concerns itself with the hardware addresses. It concerns itself with the access control on the media, as into who's going to use the media when, which is your Mac. And it also concerns itself with the size of the chunks of data that are actually transferred over the physical media, and they are called frames. So the layer 2 data link layer PDU is called a frame. We had a question in one of the tests about this once, where you had to actually line them all up with the ones that they actually were. But that's all good. Okay, the network layer is responsible for... it is responsible for getting data from one place to another. It is responsible for routing. It is responsible for addressing. And it is not concerned with reliability, and it is not concerned with error correction. It is just concerned with getting data from one end to the other. And it's considered a best effort system. The PDU for the network layer is packets. Any questions so far? Okay. The transport layer is concerned with end-to-end reliability. It is concerned with the segmentation of data. It is concerned with error detection. It is concerned with retransmission algorithms, and it is concerned with reliable transport of data. And the PDU for the transport layer is segments. Okay, so basically the PDUs, we have bits at the physical layer, we have frames at the data link layer, we have packets at the network layer, we have segments at the transport layer, and we have data at the application layer. Any questions on that?
What about the session and presentation layers?
They don't have PDUs as such. They have their own headers and stuff that get added, but there aren't actually PDUs for those specific layers. You could say the PDU for the session layer was a session, but you wouldn't say the PDU for a presentation layer was a presentation, because that's not how it works. Okay, so we're talking initially about the transport layer. Hang on, I'm just going to kill the radio. Give me a sec. Ah, much better. Okay. It is a happier world when advertising is not present, in my experience. Transport layer concerns itself with end-to-end reliability. In other words, getting data from point A to point Q through all those little squiggly clouds and having it turn up at point Q in a form that is understandable and correct and all that sort of good stuff. It employs error handling mechanisms, so if something goes wrong, your best friend's picture on Facebook doesn't look all garbled. Now, the transport layer prepares data for transmission over the network. Okay, so as I explained a couple of weeks ago, and it was a couple of weeks ago, so we'll do it again, data starts at the top of the OSI reference model. It starts at the layer 8, which is the bogon layer, which is the loose nut sitting behind the computer, the user, okay? And then it goes through the application layer, and the application then packages up the data and shovels it down to the presentation layer, which takes care of all the character sets and all that sort of guff. It's then sent down to the session layer, and the session layer is responsible for all the sessions, opening and closing of sessions, and making sure there's a session established and all that sort of stuff. And then we go down to the transport layer, and coming up on the transport layer, after we've gone down through the transport layer and segmentation has happened, we go down to the network layer. And once we've gone down to the network layer, it's put into packets and it's shoveled across the network, and then it goes down to the data link layer and it's put into frames and shoveled across the actual medium, and then we go all the way down to the physical layer and it's actually modulated onto whatever media we're using, fiber, radio, copper, etc. Then it gets to the other side and it goes all the way back the other way. Okay, so all the way up from the physical layer back to the data link layer, which then becomes frames, and it goes back through the network layer, and it becomes packets, and then it goes through the transport layer, and it becomes segments, and it goes back through the session layer, and it becomes so your sessions and your presentation handles your character set stuff, and then it goes back through the application layer, and it goes back up to the applications, and it goes back up to the user at the other end of the network. Sounds like that Three Little Ducks Went Out One Day song, but that's essentially what happens with the OSI reference model.
So in the OSI reference model, the application presentation session layer is equivalent to just the application layer on the TCP/IP?
I'm just going to check something. I was just going to ask my boss, and he's not here, so I'm just going to make it up now. I believe that the session, some of the See, it depends on who you talk to, because the session layer actually has some parts that overlap into the transport layer with TCP/IP. So if you look at, you've got network access, you've got transport, and then you've got application. So the transport layer in TCP tends to contain the transport layer of the OSI reference model and the session layer.
Yeah, I thought that was a little bit of overlapping there. It was just a little confusing.
Yeah, there is some overlapping. So the transport layer of TCP/IP also includes functions from the session layer of the OSI reference model.
So how does the session layer work? Is it looking at sequence numbers of packets or what?
We get to that further down in the well, you've got to understand that TCP doesn't map to the OSI reference model. It doesn't. It came out like 10 years beforehand, okay? So you cannot do a direct mapping between the OSI reference model and the TCP model, because anything you map is going to be an approximation. Because TCP/IP came out first, it wasn't designed by a big committee, and it works. Unlike most things in the OSI reference model, which there are very few protocols that are actually OSI compliant, because it's just too much overhead and bureaucracy and stuff. It's more of a learning tool. Sessions are handled by the TCP stack. So when you open a TCP connection, which is discussed later in the notes, you send your SYN packet, you then get your ACK packet, you then send your SYN packet again, and then the TCP connection is considered open, and your sequence numbers increase and your acknowledgement numbers increase until you send a FIN packet, and then the other end sends a FIN packet, and it's all over. Okay. However, UDP has no concept of session. However, there is a socket that is kept open for a certain period of time in the operating system, so you could argue that there is sort of the analogy of a session at the operating system level as to whether a UDP socket has been left open. So the session.
This is where the whole thing. This is where the whole thing, you know, sort of became confusing because of the overlap. So you read chapter 4, you say, okay, transport has all of this, the three-way handshake, etc., etc. Then you go back and say, wait a minute, what did the session layer do? So this, I don't know even how this OSM model is a learning tool, because it's making the whole thing confusing.
Well, the idea of the OSI reference model is to give you one seven-layer model that can be applied to any protocol. So you can apply the OSI reference model to AppleTalk, you can apply it to IPX, SPX, you can apply it to NetBUI, you can apply it to TCP/IP, you can apply it to DECnet, you can ARCNet, whatever you want to happen to put it to. So the OSI reference model is used because it can be applied no matter what protocol is running on the wires. And then, because TCP just happens to be the most popular, it would be, you tend to talk about TCP the most, TCP/IP protocol suite the most. But there are other protocols still out there, like DNA, SNA, and all the mainframe protocols and stuff, which is why we have the OSI reference model. It also helps vendors being able to communicate with each other and stuff. And Cisco's big on it, so that's what we teach. It can be seen as a confusion tool, but that's what I hear from every student until they understand it. And then when the penny finally drops, they go, "Oh, okay, we can map all this stuff to the OSI reference model, and it's all good." Or at least that's what we're led to believe.
So, in other words, the OSI reference model basically is just conceptual.
Yeah, it's purely conceptual. It's absolutely conceptual. It's a reference model. It's a model. It's not real. It's pretendy-tendy networky thing, okay, with bits of string and stuff, okay? It's conceptual. You don't sort of walk over and see little, you know, data link layer packets zotting out of a router. This is all conceptual.
So basically, if you were to look at a router's output, all you'd see is a bunch of, well, ons and offs going across the wire, basically?
Depends on where you look at it. If you look at it from with a multimeter, you might see lots of ons and offs going off over a wire, although you'd have to be pretty quick because they're going to happen in microseconds. So I'd suggest lots of coffee if we're looking in that. Or you can look at it at layer 2, and you can look at what sort of frames are going across the wire as to whether they're Ethernet frames or DECnet frames or ARCNet frames or whatever else. Then if you look at layer 3, you could be looking at, and see, I'm back on the OSI reference model again, gotta love it. Back at layer 3, you're looking at the network layer, you're looking at the source IP addresses, you're looking at the destination IP addresses, you're looking at the time to lives, you're looking at the fragment offsets, that sort of thing. Then if we wander up to layer 4, you can then start looking at the segments, and you can look at, sequence numbers and acknowledgements and stuff. So it all depends at, I mean, if you think of a cake, all right, let's think of a sponge cake, all right, because I like sponge cake, and I'd love some sponge cake right now. A sponge cake, if you just look at a sponge cake, it's just a big round thing that sort of sits on the plate with jam and cream and icing sugar, okay? But if you look further down the level of sponge cake, we can find out that the jam is made from fruit and sugar, and the cream is... well, it comes out of a cow, we don't worry too much about that. And the cake is made of flour and eggs and all those sorts of things. So it just depends on how deeply you look at something as to which units you're looking at, if that makes any sense.
Gotcha. Okay, so it depends on what you need to see.
Pretty much. It depends on exactly what aspects of the communications flow you're looking at. So, we could just say, well, it's cool because you send your packets in one end of the internet and then they get to the other end. And it's all good. And that's all we need to know. But when it breaks, as a network technician, you need to be able to figure out which bit of the network is actually broken. Do you have a jabbering transceiver? Do you have a router too many hops away? Do you have a fragmentation problem? Is your MTU set too low? Is the cable unplugged? The whole point of this detail as to how networks function, and a lot of you might be thinking to yourselves, yeah, but I just turn on my computer and launch Internet Fox and pull up, FaceTube, and it all works beautifully. But the fact is that when it doesn't work, as a network technician, you need to be able to figure out which bits of it don't work, and which bits of it are problematic, and how you're going to track down the problem with the network. Is the cable unplugged? Is the MTU too high? How many people here have had anything to do with ADSL?
I'm on ADSL, actually.
Okay. Anybody...
plenty.
Anybody had the problem you set up a router and you set your MTU too high and you don't turn on MSS clamping and then you go in and Telnet works and the web doesn't? And that's always fun. Anybody seen that? Yeah, isn't it great? And then you go on and you sift a whole lot of forums if you can get them to load on the one device that you happen to have installed the Dr. TCP on, and you find that you actually have to clamp your MSS at 1460 and then everything works just fine because the maximum packet you can get through a PPPoE link is 1,492 bytes. And that is at the data link layer. And guys, if you hadn't been doing this course or you hadn't tripped over this before, you wouldn't know this, so you wouldn't be able to fix it.
Why would you set it that high to begin with?
Because if you set it too low, you end up with more overhead from all of the packets. Like if you set your MTU to 576 bytes, and you wanted to send, say, 1500 bytes, you'd be looking at sending three packets with all of their 40-byte TCP headers for the packets that you're sending, which would be less efficient than if you were to send one packet with 1460 bytes in it.
That's how I learned about MTUs and window sizes and things, because when I first got DSL, it would work or not, it would not work, or it would be incredibly slow, and manipulating those settings actually made it much quicker.
Oh, it does. And you can wander around all of these, speedguide.net forums and stuff and find out, what settings to set. There is also some wisdom that if you actually set the MT MTU to a multiple of the ADSL cell size, you can get even more speed out of it because it won't have to worry about using sort of fragments of ATM cells and stuff. That's a bit too extreme for me, but it can be done. And it is important that if you are setting up an ADSL connection and it isn't one of those, D-Link 123, my first router, if you're doing something that's a little more advanced, and if you guys get through Exploration 2 and 3, and it's possible you will be doing those things that are more advanced, or you're running Linux, or you're running another operating system that gives you the power to twiddle all the knobs, you may need to concern yourself with those technical details because the router may not clamp the MSS for you because as far as it's concerned, you tell it when it needs to do these sorts of things. And in fact, when I set up the Cisco here, which was an 878, one of the specific things I had to do was I actually did have to clamp the MSS on the internet, LAN side of the internet link, to ensure that the packets weren't going to be too big to go over the ADSL link. And anybody who's read Chapter 5, can anybody tell me what happens to a packet if the do not fragment bit is set and it's larger than the MTU?
It's dropped.
It's dropped.
Exactly, which means that, Facebook.com doesn't load because there was this big packet full of image data that never made it.
What does that mean to clamp the MSS?
Well, one of the parameters in TCP is the maximum segment size. And the maximum segment size is the size of the data payload minus the size of the TCP header. And if you clamp the MSS, it means that you set the MSS so that it can go no higher than a specific value, which is usually the MTU minus the TCP header. Okay, so we digress slightly, but it's all quite interesting, and maybe one day you guys will come across this stuff, and it's something that's worth being aware of. One of the other things you can do on gigabit networks, for example, is you can increase your MTU. You can use jumbo frames, so you can have 7K packets or 9K packets or 3K packets, or sometimes you can have even bigger packets. But it is important that if you are going to increase your MTU above 1500 bytes, that your switches handle those large packets, otherwise the frames will be ditched.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Be careful. The first time I got gigabyte devices, I was playing with it. I had one of those little cheap 8-port D-Link switches that worked at a gigabyte, but it didn't do jumbo frames, and I couldn't. It took me a long time to figure out, how come this used to work and now it doesn't?
Well, interestingly enough, I've actually discovered that jumbo frames really don't do that much for you. I was actually doing a lot of research on this on Monday, because I got no life. And it's actually the windowing parameters and whether you've got selective acknowledgement enabled, and there's actually some tweaks you can apply to your Windows XP TCP stack. I haven't actually played with Windows 7 to see how much of this is done by default. And it's actually the windowing parameters and the retransmit parameters and stuff that make a bigger difference, and it is actually possible to get 100 megabytes per second with a 1500 MTU, as I discovered on my network the other day. So there you go. Okay, any other pending questions before we go on with the actual lecture content? How many people have got gigabit out of morbid curiosity? Brian's got gigabit. I've got gigabit. Anybody else got gigabit?
Got a gigabit card, but I don't have a gigabit router.
Nah, it doesn't count.
Unless Tomato magically turned it on, but I doubt it's capable.
No, if you've got a Linksys, you won't have have gigabit switches unless it's a high-end Linksys. And I don't. Yeah.
Well, I mean these firmwares do let me do a bunch of crap that I couldn't, do in the low-end ones that you can in the high-end ones, but I doubt that's one of them.
Yeah, look, for most people, 10100 is just fine. It's not until you're copying, 4 gig of data across the network that 10100 involves you going and making a beverage of your choice. Okay, so the layer, the transport layer prepares. pairs data for transmission over the network. As we discussed last week, it segments the data so that no particular application monopolizes the network, or at least that's the theory. Back in 1995, we had a 10BASE-2 network at our technical college. If anybody knows, 10BASE-2 is coaxial cable, 50 ohm coax with T-pieces and terminators. Anybody seen that?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the one where if you pull the terminator off the end, all the packets fall out and the network stops working. Or at least that's what you tell the secretary. You know, the terminator had come off the end and the secretary was wondering what was wrong with the network, and she was just like, oh, so does that mean all the packets fell out the end? And it was just easier to say yes than to explain what had actually happened.
It fell out of the end of one of the internet series of two.
It fell out of the end of the T-piece. Yeah, you know, all the packets were going all over the floor. Okay, so the transport
try to sweep up the packet.
That's right. Well, they're special network packets. You can't see them and you can't feel them, but they've fallen out the end there. Let me, you know. Anyway, seriously, the transport layer adds headers to allow the segmentation of the data, and this is where we talk about all this sequence number stuff, and it allows the segments to be assembled back into a stream. Okay, so TCP. We're talking about TCP when we're talking about the segments. You can fragment datagrams, UDP datagrams. However, because it is possible for network packets to arrive out of order if the packets have gone over different routes, it's also possible for the UDP fragments to turn up in the wrong order. And if your protocol cares about the data that's in the UDP fragments, for example, OpenVPN uses UDP, it is up to the upper-level application to handle the reassembly of that stream rather than the actual transport layer as it would be with TCP. Okay, applications do not need to know specifics of the network that the data is travelling on at the transport layer. They don't care if it's wireless, if it's fibre, if it's whatever it happens to be. It doesn't really matter at the transport layer. As long as that data can be segmented up and put onto the network and those segments can be reassembled, it doesn't matter about the media that you're using. Alright, everybody's happy that TCP uses port numbers to differentiate between conversations. When you initiate a connection on your workstation, it binds to a source IP and a source port. It establishes, if it's connecting to some sort of server, it establishes a connection to the IP address of the server and the port that the server happens to be listening on for that particular service. So, for example, it could be connecting to one of Google's servers on port 80. Okay, then the packets that come back from the server come from the source IP address of the server and port 80 to your machine and the listening port that your machine had allocated on the outbound direction. Okay, ports, remember, 1024 to 49,152 are the ports that your machine will tend to allocate outbound as it establishes connections. And if you boot up Windows, and right after it boots up and right after you've logged in, before you've done lots of stuff on it, you crack open the command prompt and run netstat, you'll actually notice that the outbound connections in the source port, they're around 1,027, 1,030, 1,036. We'll leave that up for a bored student to try later, okay? But it's just as soon as you boot it up, you crack open netstat, and you run netstat from the command prompt, and you'll see that the source ports of your outgoing connections and stuff to things like MSN Messenger are in a fairly low range. Okay, TCP provides... hang on, I've got a braille display here, look at this. Connection-oriented conversations, reliable delivery, ordered data reconstruction, and flow control. Hey, I cut and pasted a bullet list out of the notes, but hey, I'm allowed to do that, okay? It's a good bullet list. I'd recommend you cut and paste those bullet lists into your notes too at some point if you're the notes taking type. Just out of morbid curiosity, does anybody take notes on lecture? Or from lecture or not?
I usually do.
I take notes from lecture, yes.
Okay, you don't have to do it the first time through. I mean, perhaps some people take the notes from the recording. Once the recording's been posted, they'll take their notes from there and then, yeah. But, yeah. It's okay, Drew. We wouldn't expect you to take notes. That'd be too much like hard work.
Indeed. And I abhor that.
Don't we know
Which is it. Why I'm going into networking as a career.
Exactly. That sort of reminds me. I remember there back in 1995, there were a whole lot of girls getting involved in IT because it paid well. And then when they actually sort of got 2 months into the course, they went, but this stuff's really hard. It's really complex. And we're like, yeah, that's why we get lots of money.
Yep.
That said, we are very happy that there are more females in IT now that it's 2010 and that they don't find the whole thing impossible, and that's absolutely amazing. We're all for women in IT, but back in 1995 it was quite a quite a situation.
Back in 1995, yeah, networking was probably about 20 times harder than it is.
I would agree with that. We didn't have universal plug and play. We were dealing with about four or five different protocols. Back in the day, Windows 95 ran NetBUI by default. Anybody remember NetBUI?
Yeah, it wasn't about TCP/IP, I think. I remember doing something with it.
No. Windows 95 had TCP installed. No, it had NetBUI installed by default. And IPX SPX was installed as well by default under Windows 95. Under 3.1, you didn't actually get TCP/IP at all. You got NetBUI by default. And NetBUI was really good for local network segments and stuff. Wasn't any good outside local network segments.
TCP/IP working for DOS.
Yeah, I got TCP working for DOS. But yeah, with Windows 3.1 and 3.11, you actually had to install Win32s. And of course, the good thing about Win32s was that you got FreeCell under Windows 3.1 and 3.11. But the interesting thing with Windows 3.1 and Windows 3.11 was that TCP/IP wouldn't work over dial-up connections. You actually had to buy and install Trumpet WinSock or another solution. It was only TCP/IP for local area networks, just to give you some idea of how networking has improved.
Oh, I had a shell account those days, so I would dial in, and we used to have this thing about emulating TCP/IP over a shell. I don't know how that was done, but we were monkeying with WinSock every second day.
Yeah, there's also some programs like Slurp that would do a slip connection over a shell account. And then there was a thing called TRSH or something that would also do it. And anyway, lots of fun times. I have shell accounts, but that's because I own Linux boxes, and I'm a big fan of the shell. If we had infinite funding, I would write a Linux course because that would be really cool. A shell account is where you can log into a machine and use a Unix shell to perform your network surfing. You can read email, you can surf the web, usually using links or something, and you do everything from the command line on a text-based terminal. Okay, TCP is end-to-end reliable, handles data correction, all that sort of stuff that I said before. UDP is fire and forget. The packets are sent out, and the other end will probably get them, but it might not. Pieces of data in UDP are called datagrams. Okay, that's just the UDP datagrams. Sort of makes them sound kind of cool. The TCP header is 20 bytes, and the UDP header is 8 bytes, which means that there is a lot more overhead for TCP than there is for UDP. Now, as the notes say, a combination of an IP address and a port number is known as a socket. Okay? So, www.google.com:80 is a socket. 192.168.47.8:1096 is a socket. When you have a source socket and a destination socket, you have a socket pair, and that gives you a connection. Well-known server ports, 0 to 1023, okay? Usually, if you are running an operating system such as Linux or a Unix or a Mac, you need administrative privileges to be able to bind a port that's less than 1024. Okay, so general users cannot bind a port under 1024, generally speaking, on Unixes and Macs and that sort of thing. Register ports 1024 to 49,151 are the ones that can either be used dynamically for outbound stuff, and they can also be used for non-fixed services and stuff. So you'll find a lot of peer-to-peer networks and stuff operate in this range, things like BitTorrent, Emule, Kazaa, all that sort of stuff. Okay, 49,152 to 65,536 are the ones that are dynamic, and they are just used for whatever. They're not actually bound to anything specifically. There are some port peer-to-peer protocols that do use those high port numbers, but generally they are considered for dynamic use, and they are not generally listed in the IANA assigned numbers documents. Okay, any questions so far? The last port number is 65,535 because it's a 16-bit field. 0 to 65,535 or 0 to 16 ones in binary. TCP must create a session between two hosts for it to function, and once the session is created, it will actually allow data traversal in both directions on the TCP sockets. Okay, now did everybody understand the sequence numbers and the acknowledgement numbers? The sequence number is the number of bytes that has been sent in the stream plus one, and then the acknowledgement number is the same as what the sequence number was to show that all of the bytes have been received and that it expects to see the byte, the next byte that is actually referenced in the sequence number. Did everybody understand that?
Yeah, but it starts with a random number, right? The sequence number. I think there is something in the notes there which says it picks up a random number, and then let's say if you're sending 40 bytes, it'll add 40 bytes to that, etc., etc.
If anybody has read the book by Kevin Mitnick called Takedown, it's probably available from Bookshare. We call it Bookshare over here because we don't get access to the full catalogue. It actually talks about sequence number guessing attacks, and when thanks for that. That's all right. I've got somebody who's in Bookshare, so I actually do have access to that resource because she's American. That's all good. Of course, she can't give me the books; she has to read them to me. Of course, only. Anyway, back to the lecture. If you start the sequence numbers at 1 or start the sequence numbers at 0, it is possible to actually guess what the sequence numbers are going to be and spoof your way into a TCP connection, which can be important if you're trying to hack into RSH sessions which were unencrypted, which was how Kevin Mitnick hacked into that fella's Spark boxes, Solaris boxes, because they didn't have random session. Random sequence number stuff. I'm surprised actually that Takedown isn't available somewhere on the net. It should be. I don't think it'd be legal though. Some of the books you can actually get, for example, some of the cryptography books and stuff you can actually get legally freely online under Creative Commons, but I don't think Takedown is one of them.
Okay, what's the difference between the acknowledgement number and the acknowledgement flag? Because there is something there about significant bits being set. Where does all that fit in?
Well, the acknowledgement number is acknowledging that you've received a certain number of bytes in the TCP stream. And if you are using selective acknowledgement, that matters because you can actually say, well, I've actually received up to byte 40,000, and then the sender can go, oh, you need byte 40,001 onwards. But when you send an acknowledgement bit back, when you send an acknowledgement packet back, you must set the acknowledgement bit. Otherwise, the TCP stack doesn't know that it's an acknowledgement packet. How would you differentiate between an acknowledgement packet and a data packet returning in the other direction if you didn't have an acknowledgement bit that you could set?
Oh, okay.
See, if I was writing the notes, that statement would have been in there. So when you actually send packets out, you set them with a SYN bit, and then when the packet comes back the other way, it's actually got the acknowledgement bit set. So when it talks about all this three-way handshake and stuff, which you can read through in your notes because it is quite well spelled out there, it sends out a SYN packet with a sequence number, it then gets an acknowledgement number back, and then it then sends out another SYN packet with the acknowledgement number it got back, and it synchronizes the sequence numbers before the session gets started.
You know, in the notes, they have these very nice packet illustrations. So they'll show you the SYN number, they'll show you the acknowledgement number, but there is some hex data below that. What is that? Is that the actual representation, or that something else?
That's the actual representation, because keep in mind, if the SYN bit is set, it's actually embedded in a binary field that you would just see as a binary field. Although if you look at a packet dump with Wireshark, it will actually, there are two ways of showing the sequence number. One of them is to show you the sequence number starting at whatever the TCP stack set it as, so the sequence number might start at 13,804. But the other way that Wireshark can show you the sequence numbers is it can start the sequence number from 1. It can say, well, the first packet is 1, and then we go 2, and then we go 3, and then we go 4, and it depends on how you would like to see the sequence number. And in fact, some of the command line options to T-Shark, which are documented in its man page, and probably on the wiki somewhere, can actually tell you how T-Shark is going to dump those sequence numbers. So a little exercise for everybody. If you haven't installed Wireshark on your system, you might want to grab it and install it by next week, because I might be writing some labs that will allow us to play with this thing a bit and get to see some of these packets in real time. You can fire up T-Shark and give it some limiting parameters and then ping something and watch the packets go backwards and forwards. Now, with the segments, if the segments are arriving out of order, all segments are stored in a buffer and they are handed up to the application once they are reordered. They're not handed up to the application first. This is with TCP. The segments are reordered and then handed up to the application. The maximum number of segments that you can have in your buffer is governed by the maximum TCP window size. Okay? So the bigger your TCP windows, the more memory your TCP connections are going to use on your computer. Obviously, because we've got gigabytes of memory in 2010, it's less of a problem. But back in 1984, you often had a maximum window size of 65,536 bytes, because that was really big and that was a lot of memory, especially when you were looking at 640K of memory. Interestingly enough, under Windows XP, it is possible to turn on large windows. And you do that by editing the registry and putting a couple of key, double word values into the H key, local machine, current control set keys, and you can Google that up. Make sure you've got backups of your registry or you've taken a restore point, because if you break it, you get to keep both pieces. Or you can use Dr. TCP to do it, and you can also enable selective acknowledgement. This is important if you are sending data over long distance links, because once the round trip time of the link increases, windowing becomes a very important factor as to how fast data can travel over the internet. Now, the good thing with selective ACK is if you've got that enabled and both ends support it, only the missing segments need to be transmitted. Now, without selective ACK, if you're up to segment 37 and then a couple more segments come out, say segment 39 and segment 40, and then segment 37 never shows up, you actually need to resend segment 37 again, 38. You can't actually selectively go, I need 38, 39, and 41. Window size is dynamic. The maximum window size is negotiated at the start of a TCP connection. It can shrink and grow based on network conditions. If there are too many retransmits or whatever, the TCP stack can actually reduce the window size and scale it down. And then as the network reliability increases, the window size can be scaled back up again. There are various algorithms for window size shrinkage and growing, such as Reno and Cubic and a few other ones, and it's all quite complicated, so we don't go into it, but Wikipedia will tell you more than you ever wanted to know. Any questions on Chapter 4? Now, I'm a lot happier with that Chapter 4 lecture than I was with last week's, but has anybody got any questions? Okay, you're all in stunned silence, or you've got no questions. Well, if segments arrive out of order, The segments need to be rearranged so that when the application sees the actual underlying data that's embedded in the segments, that all of the data is in order. Otherwise, you might end up with bits of HTML that do the search box, followed by bits of HTML that do the header, followed by bits of HTML that do the footer, which would make no sense to the browser. It would be like having a conversation where you said, "I'm well, thanks. How about you? Hello? Hello? Yeah, see you later. So, are you coming over for lunch?" I mean, that wouldn't make a lot of sense. Okie dokie. Chapter 5. The network layer. This is layer 3 of the OSI reference model, and it is also fairly much an analog of the TCP/IP model, network equals network. Okay, happy, happy, joy, joy. All right. The protocol unit for the protocol data unit, or the PDU, for the network layer is... Can anybody tell me? What is the protocol data unit for the network layer? It's a packet. Okay. Packets have source and destination addresses. If we're talking TCP/IP or IPv4, they have IPv4 addresses. If we're talking IPv6, they have IPv6 addresses. This is where we look at having a packet from 192.168.10.4 to 192.168.10.12. They are the source and destination IP addresses. We will not go into IP addresses much in this chapter, except to say that they are 32 bits long. Fear not. We will be so into IP addresses next week, you'd wished that you weren't at Chapter 6's lecture, okay? So we are going to go into them quite heavily, and then we're going to talk about subnetting, and then we're going to talk about binary conversions, and I'm going to try and teach everybody how to convert bucket. Binary to decimal. Yes, a packet. It'll be a packet of fun. Okay, I was just checking the ping there, because I thought we were delayed, but we've got a ping of 76, which isn't too bad. Okay, packets are routed at the network layer. Can anybody tell me the type of device that is responsible for routing packets? Is anybody still awake? Yes, it's a router. Anyone still awake? Okay, just checking. Because it's quite easy to sort of fall asleep and start snoring and not land on the talk key, so I'd never know. I know, guys, it's boring, 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 but it's really important, okay? What can I say? This is how networks work. Well, you could do that, but... That's okay. Well, I think we'll pass. Okay, a router. Packets travel through routers. And each router that a packet travels through is called a hop. Okay? Not the sort of hop that Skippy does. It's a networking hop. People should have seen the term hop when they did traceroute. Everybody seen the term hop?
Yeah, or a maximum of 30 hops, which you can change.
Okay, IPv4 does the following. I suppose they hop until they drop or something. Okay? No connection. The connection is not established before... No logical connection is established before the packets are sent, okay? There might be a physical connection, but there is no logical connection before the packets are sent. It is up to the transport layer to deal with whether there is a session or not. It's not up to IP. The packets just get sent. Best effort. In other words, we don't guarantee they get there. You send the packet from 192.168.10.10 to 192.168.10.20, and you send it, and it might get there, and it might not. And it's up to the high-level protocols to figure out whether it did or it didn't, if that in fact matters. Media independent. It operates independently to whatever media you're putting it over, so we're still dealing with media independent stuff here. So whether it's fiber, whether it's wireless. There is one parameter at the network layer, however, that is media dependent, and that is the maximum transmission unit, which is the largest size of a datagram that can be sent over a particular medium. Time to live is an 8-byte field, an 8-bit field, I should say, 1-byte field, 8-bit, in the header of the TCP packet. It is sent or the IP packet, I should say. It is set to an arbitrary value, usually 64 or 128 or 255, or if you're running Windows 95, it's set to 32. And each time the packet is sent through a router, the TTL is decremented by 1. When the TTL is decremented by 1, and it eventually reaches zero, a time exceeded message is sent back to the source, which is interestingly enough how traceroute works. It actually sets the time to live on the first packet to 1, and then when it passes through the first router, a time exceeded message comes back from the first router, and that's how you can find out what the IP address of the first router. So if you have a firewall that blocks ICMP, that's why traceroute might not work. TTL is designed to prevent routing loops. If you have a series of routers and router 1 is set to send packets to router 2, which is set to send packets to router 3, which is set to send packets to router 4, which is set packets to set to router 1, without a TTL, the packets would go round and around and around and around and around. Any questions on that?
You know, you'll probably cover this next chapter, but you said that TTL is actually a field that said it's a bit. So then how do...
No.
You know, if it's...
No. It's an 8-bit okay. field. It's an 8-bit field. It's a byte.
It's a byte. Great. Now, one byte means one character, and yet my TTL is 16 seconds or whatever else, or some arbitrary number. So is that the bit to binary conversion or something, or what?
Yeah, if you convert the TTL into binary and pad it with zeros on the left-hand side, so if your TTL was 16, the byte would be 00001000. You would convert 16 into binary and pack it out to 8 bits, and that would be your TTL field.
Oh, okay. Hmm.
But TTL is one byte, whether it's set to 4 or whether it's set to 16 or whether it's set to, you know, 63 or whatever. And if anybody wants to see TTL in action, if you ping your default gateway, generally speaking, yes, well, yes, if you ping your default gateway, you should get TTLs back from the pings that are one less than the maximum TTL. And then if you ping something a few hops away from you, you will actually get a TTL that is somewhat lower than that.
Yeah, we actually use this for guessing operating systems, because some OSs apparently have, you know, fixed TTLs. You know, Windows, I think, has 128 and so on.
Depends which version of Windows. As I said, Windows 95 has 32, and various other operating systems have different things. There's actually a utility called QSO, which actually prods the TCP stack and tries to guess what the operating system is based on various quirks in the stack. And it's actually quite a complex application. I'm not answering that. And it can actually figure out with quite an amount of reliability what application you're working with, what operating system you're working with. So if you have a Unix box at your disposal, or you wish to download one of the virtual machines off qcat.org, and you can email me and ask me for the passwords, you can play with things like QSO. You can install them onto your virtual Linux box, which you can telnet to with TerraTerm. And I would strongly recommend people getting into the virtual machines, because I'm going to get you into them anyway. So you can always start first and play with TerraTerm and get TerraTerm set up and configured, rather than messing with it in about 3 weeks' time.
Actually, you can use Nmap on Windows and do something similar. Well, that's okay.
Yes, but you'd actually have to look up what all of the TCP values are, all of the quirks in the stack are. I don't think Nmap... Nmap has some of it in, but I think QSO has a more up-to-date database. Actually, Wireshark, I think, does some operating system determination as well. But the GUI of that isn't particularly great. Okay, the type of service is a thing that sets the priority of the packets, and if the router decides to honour the type of service bits, which it doesn't need to, but it can, that can cause packets to be treated as urgent and that sort of stuff. A lot of routers don't take any notice of the type of service bits, and a lot of peer-to-peer applications just set the type of service to being mega urgent, do it right now, and it ends up swamping other traffic, which is why there is more to traffic shaping and control than there is to just setting the type of service bits. Now, IP has a header checksum, and the header checksum has to be valid for the packet to be seen as being useful and good and stuff, and if the header checksum is invalid, the packet is dropped. I wouldn't recommend a router that does quality of service, because they all do it differently, and depending on who you talk to, you can have religious wars about whether Tomato is better than DDWRT, or whether HyperWRT is better than Tomato, or should I be using a Linksys, or should I be using a Linux box, or should I be using a Netgear, rah, rah, rah. So, you don't know. It's like whether should you buy an Apple or a PC. I personally have my ADSL mode, a modem set to pass-through mode, and I have a point-to-point over Ethernet session running on my Fit PC, which is a little square box that uses 5 watts of power, has 2 Ethernet interfaces, and runs Linux. But I'm not your average network user, so maybe my first router 1-2-3 would be more the thing for most users. Okay, the other thing that's worth mentioning is that as packets travel through the network, their source and destination IP addresses remain the same. As they're shoveled through the router so that it can tell where the packets came from and where they're destined to. And it's the TTLs that are decremented, and the routers are responsible for shoveling the packets from one network to another and making sure that end-to-end connectivity is maintained. All right, anybody got any questions? They're all of the notes I have for today. What chapter exams are people up to at the moment? I know Pranav has had a shot at chapter 4. Is anybody as far as chapter 4?
I did chapter 4.
Has anyone not done chapter 1? Sorry, chapter 2, I should say. Anyone not done chapter 2? There was no exam for chapter 1.
Will the router add...
Will the router add? That's all right.
Will
Curtis.
The router add a header while routing, from one hop to the other hop? Or how does that bit work in the routing table?
No, it doesn't add any headers. It just hands the packet on to the router, and it then keeps the packet intact and just hands it on to the next router to the best of its knowledge.
So basically, when you route a message across the internet, you have all these different routers that have to figure out where each other router is that it knows.
That's right. The router. The router is responsible for figuring out where the packet has to go, but there is no where did this packet come from previously stuff. That's up to the routing protocols. Routers have their own protocols to negotiate which router is closer and which router is the cheapest to contact and which router is the closest vector. So the packets are handed from the routers, and then when a router gets a packet, its job is to hand on the packet to the next router that is going to be the best choice based on its routing table and its knowledge, and then when it gets on to the next router, the same thing happens. The next router looks at its routing table and hands the packet to the destination that it thinks is going to be the best based on its routing table. Which is why it is possible for a router to hand a packet to router 2, and then a router 2 hands it back to router 1, and router 1 hands it to router 2, and router 2 hands it back to 1, and then eventually the TTL expires, and the packet gets thrown away. Okay, any other questions before I hit stop?